we just, I thought the, did you read the other essay? The one by the Gallison Park person about...
I know the other, though.
Yeah, it's the, I don't know, they didn't seem to disagree on any fundamental points. So, that one has footnotes.
Maybe that's a good place for your introduction.
Yeah, so maybe we can do that. So what I'm gonna do is just kind of run through, just to help us all be a little bit on the same page, what exactly cybernetics was. I mean, this text touches on a lot of the high points of the history, but it does it in a kind of elliptical fashion that assumes you already kind of know it. So I think it's useful to sort of just run through what we're talking about when we're talking about cybernetics. Okay, so this word cybernetics actually really old. It actually comes up, we get it all the way back in Socrates, or in Plato, in a dialogue, Alcibiades 1. And it's basically a text about government, right? It's a text in which Socrates is basically trying to draw out from his interlocutor what it means to govern, right? Is governing just about power? Is governing just about, kind of unchallenged authority, right? Or is there a kind of skill? Is there a kind of art to governing? And so here's the quote. Or again, in a ship, if a man having the power to do what he likes has no intelligence or skill in navigation, and that's, I guess here it's arete cyberneticos, do you see what will happen to him and to his fellow sailors? Right? So it's like, it doesn't matter, if the captain's in charge, right, and the captain is like, doesn't have that ability to understand how to get the ship safely past the obstacles it's facing. It doesn't matter how in charge he is, right? If the captain's like, all right, we're all just going to go chase this one whale, right? Things are going to go badly for the crew, right? So there needs to be this, there's this idea that there is a kind of art of government, right? An art of steering that's going to be sort of like moving between, kind of getting around external obstacles, right? Dealing with contingency, right, and with the limitations that that authority is unchecked, or authority is checked by these kind of external obstacles. At least that's kind of the reading that those people are giving at this kind of thing, right? Now this word actually has a really interesting etymological history, right? So cybernetes becomes government, right? So our word for government, our word for this word for this activity that is related to the practice of the state, but that is not rule or be in charge or hold dominion, right? But to govern, right, has a root in this word, this Greek root cybernetes. Right. So this is a kind of interesting fact, and it's an interesting fact because we can think about like, well, what happens? What does it mean to govern, right? And what's interesting is that the way the word cybernetics gets picked up and deployed is precisely because of this kind of etymological history, right? Precisely because of some of the things that people start calling governors, right? In the, I guess, called the early modern period. Right, so here's Watts's governor. And Watts, James Watts, built the first steam engine. Of course, he didn't really build the first steam engine. He also didn't build the first governor, but you often hear Watts's governor being referred to. It's a kind of old mechanism. It's a really clever mechanism, right? This is going back to 1788. And what you've got here is, you basically imagine this is this is connected to your steam engine, right? And your steam engine, say this thing on the skateboard here, is going to have another pulley. It's going to have a belt that's going to connect to this pulley, and it's going to spin this mechanism. Right? And what you want to do is make sure that your steam engine, A, is moving things, right? That's often really useful. You want to make sure that it's on, that it's powering itself, that it's providing this rotational energy. But you also want to make sure that it doesn't blow itself up. Right? If it goes too fast, if it uses, if it produces too much energy, it's going to destroy itself. It's going to get messy. So what Watts's governor did basically was this pulley would spin, right, as the engine spun. Right? And the faster this spun, you've got these lead weights basically attached to this kind of hinged arm mechanism, right? And you can imagine, right, if you're spinning something, you're spinning a ball around on a string slowly, it's going to be kind of lazily revolving around you. You get it going really, really fast, and it's going to go all the way out, right? Centripetal force, right? So what happens in that case, right, when it gets all the way up to the top, because of the way this very clever hinge mechanism is built, because of the way this, you know, is connected to a shaft and puts pressure up here. Basically, what's going to happen is it's going to raise this thing up, and when this gets raised up, to, you know, when it gets to top speed, it raises this up, and that pushes this down, right? And that turns off the steam engine, right? Or limits it, or cuts its fuel. Yep. So it's a way of making a machine regulate itself, right? It's addressed to a very, very practical problem. This is not something that comes out of high theory. Right? This is not something that arises out of a discovery like Newton's or something like that. It's a discovery of engineers, right? It's this kind of this like minor science of regulation that's you know, prevalent in all this early modern machinery. And we get Watts giving it a name, right? Or this, you know, this codification of the name is Watson's governor, right? So again, it's this art of steering, right? It's keeping the keeping the machine, keeping the system within acceptable limits. Right? Now, there's not much terribly new or exciting about that, right? In fact, you know, this is actually a kind of banal little mechanism, right? So for instance, the thermometer, right? Like I said, this is the model for power in the 20th and 21st centuries, right? This is it, right here. Behold your master in despair, right? I would be a little skeptical, right? But essentially, a thermometer is a really good example, right? You've got a spring in there. The spring gets hot. When it gets, you know, you set the length of the spring or, you know, the tension on the spring by moving the moving the temperature dial. When it gets to that certain temperature, it causes a mechanical change in the spring at that given length or tension, which then shuts off the heater, right? Or turns the heater on. And this is basically, you know, a very, very simple mechanism of feedback, right? And this is the sort of cybernetic concept, you know, par excellence, right? It's how do systems regulate? How do we build systems, right, that regulate themselves, right? And this here would be negative feedback. Cybernetics would also go into positive feedback, or positive feedback would be something that actually doesn't really get theorized, I think, that much until the birth of electronics. Right, and we get this sort of phenomena. Anybody's ever used a microphone, right? You get feedback, right? You put the microphone in front of the speaker, you make a noise, you get this kind of positive feedback loop, right? All right, so what is cybernetics besides thermometers and, you know, old things that people used to use on steam engines, right? Where is the innovation, right? Well, you could say, okay, well, the innovation is perhaps, right, thinking about life as a machine, right? And you know, so we get this moment of cybernetics, right? This is the sort of core text in cybernetics. It's, you know, very famous picture of Norbert Wiener, who in 1948 releases this book, Cybernetics, or Control and Communication in the Animal and the Machine. And this is the book that really launches this idea of cybernetics, right? Gives this gives a name to a lot of work that had been going on during the Second World War, and sort of puts it out in a way that becomes, I think, probably more popular than maybe Wiener intended. Like there's a lot of sort of popular uptake. So what's new about this, right? Well, you say, okay, well, it's this animal-machine nexus, right? It's this understanding of similar mechanisms between the animal and the machine. And that's, okay, that's not a new thing, right? You know, we have all sorts of ways of thinking about animals and machines going back, you know, to roughly the same period that we'd be talking about, say, you know, roughly the same early modern period, right? So here's Wolfenstein's famous duck, right? And that's a kind of interesting model of what a machine animal looks like. The cybernetic model is going to be different, right? The cybernetic model is going to think about life and the equivalence of life and machine in a really different way. We're not going to be talking about this kind of super mechanical assemblage of parts, right? Designed like a clockwork, designed to mimic functionality, right, to mimic external appearance, right, this kind of elaborate sort of puppet-making activity. What we're going to be thinking about is these kind of essential mechanisms of regulation. And there's an interesting sort of parallel here, right? And certainly, Tikkun is not the first people to think about the question of what do these two different kinds of machines look like, and what are their sort of political consequences. Because one of the things we know is that, you know, pretty much since the birth of political theory, life and living organisms have always been used as a reference point for what the political system looks like. Right? And there's a really excellent book by Otto Marr called Authority, Liberty, and Automatic Machinery in Early Modern Europe. Anybody read this one? It's kind of really neat. It's kind of a really neat argument. And basically the idea is that if you look at Britain, right, what you see is the birth of regulation apparatuses, right, in terms of, say, Watts's governor, right? These kind of ways, this kind of being able to engineer the sort of self-control of systems, right, is pretty much coextensive historically with the development of classical liberalism, right? So Adam Smith, Ian Griswold Head, this whole idea that somehow you could have a system in which, in which private gain-seeking activity actually provided the larger public good of making the system work in a kind of organic fashion, right? Marr's argument is that these things are happening at the same time. Now he has a historical problem in which is that he's not able to demonstrate the cabal of liberalist engineers who are like building steam engines and then thinking about how to control the world through liberalism, right? So he can't get to that level of really saying that this is explicit. He tries to sort of say this is, it's kind of like a genealogy. It's kind of like an attempt at sort of identifying a sort of historical moment that's having consequences in both fields. But anyway, the concept of self-regulation, right? It's one of the things that's interesting here is that if we're thinking about cybernetics, and we're like, okay, cybernetics is thinking about a different way of thinking about, the relationship between animal and machine. It's thinking about self-regulating systems. It's thinking about feedback loops, right? None of this is entirely new, right? In fact, you could argue that this is at the basis of liberalism, right? So we've got to keep pushing it. Be like, okay, what exactly is going into cybernetics that makes this a new historical moment? Let's see. Okay, here's a little movie to give you an idea of the cybernetic conception of life.
In a symbol around the outskirts of Bristol lives Dr. Gray Walter, a neurologist, who makes robots as a hobby. They are small, and he doesn't dress them up to look like men. He calls them tortoises. And so cunningly have their insides been designed that they respond to the stimuli of light and touch in a completely lifelike manner.
British neuroscientist, the inventor of the EKG, I think, or one of the people who was really instrumental in the early development of it. Also a bit of a kind of weird, kind of very idiosyncratic anarchist, writes for a column towards the journal Anarchy. His son actually is Nicholas Walter, who's one of the more famous British anarchists in the second half of the 20th century, who's implicated in the Spies for Peace action and all sorts of stuff. Anyway, that's all digression. But I think what's interesting is just in that little video clip, just you get a sense of maybe the three elements that are new about cybernetics, three of the sort of very broad things that are making cybernetics unique and different from, say, thinking about how to control a steam engine or thinking about society as a sort of self-regulating whole. And those three, I would say, are on the one hand, it's publicity, right? These are very, very public ideas. These are ideas that are being disseminated through the mass media. They're being used to organize a vision of the world in a way that perhaps some of these other ideas were not. Second is technology, right? There is a qualitative shift in the level of technology that's available, right? The steam engine, you know, the control of the steam engine, you had clever mechanical linkages, this kind of thing. We're talking about a sort of explosion of new technologies that cybernetics is really taking root in, right? And chief among these are these kind of electronic systems, right? These ability to build electronic circuits. So this is really important. And then the third thing I would argue is this orientation towards the future, right? That cybernetics is not viewed as like, look, we figured out how to do something, the end, right? But it's understood as opening up some sort of project, some sort of project that's going to pay off in these very, very remarkable ways. So those would be the sort of three very broad things I would say distinguishes cybernetics from some of these earlier things. But I think we also have to look at the sort of very concrete kind of historical assemblage that's going on here. Right? Like, what's feeding into cybernetics? And there's a lot of, cybernetics is this name for a discipline, but it's also a name for a kind of encounter between a lot of different other disciplines. All right, so here's one, information theory. Right? And you can see that all of these things are basically happening at roughly the same time. These are all, a lot of these technological developments, a lot of these disciplinary advances, a lot of these fundamental statements of how a field is going to work, defining concepts, are all happening out of this like tremendous mobilization of scientists that happens during the Second World War. Right? So a lot of the research that's coming out in terms of, say, cybernetics, in terms of information theory, is all coming out, a lot of it is being, say, declassified, right? A lot of it is taking place within, is coming out into the public sphere kind of fully formed, right? So information theory, Paul Shannon develops this in, publishes the really important paper in 1948, right? And this is this idea of the transmission of messages. Right, this idea of having a message be transmitted, having noise that is always kind of necessarily present, always threatening to degrade that message, right? And how does the receiver get that message and recover the meaning or recover what was encoded within it? And this is this develops a whole mathematical apparatus, right? What are the efficient ways of doing this, right? How do we structure this path so as to minimize the effects of noise? And this science is really, and these kind of mathematical results are really fundamental for a lot of the work that's done in cybernetics. Right? And what we get out of this, what we get in terms of a sort of, something that's going to go beyond, say, there'll be a whole lot of really interesting work that's done on that link, right? There'll be an equation of information and entropy that'll get made. People will basically say, like, look, you wrote this equation for what noise does to a communication signal. And it turns out that that equation, basically, I think you flip the sign around and you get the equation for what sort of like excess heat energy does, the sort of degradation of thermodynamic energy over time. And that'll be made really explicit. So there's a lot of really interesting stuff going on. The one thing I would argue that's really important for thinking through the sort of sociocultural consequences of this is not so much the connection with entropy, but just the notion of information. Just this category of information as such, this idea of, say, bits. Right? Shannon is the person who invents the word bit. And I forget exactly, anybody remember what bit stands for?
It's one of two.
What?
It's one of two options, right? Bit. So bit is base two.
Yeah, but it was like there's some abbreviation. But anyway, the idea is that information is reducible down to these very simple binary choices. Right? That you can encode that the string of zeros and ones is the simplest, but it's also a perfectly sufficient medium for encoding any message whatsoever. And this is new. This is a new concept of information. And that's going to play into some of what's going to go on with cybernetics. Okay. We've also got, as I said, technology, right? So we've got the first general purpose computers being built at this time. There's one of them. This is built, again, during the war. But the war ends, there's computers, and there's this kind of publicity mobilization to justify the existence of computers, right? To find peacetime applications for computers. So this is obviously going to be something that cybernetics is really involved with, right? Okay. There's other things that are going in here, right? There's developments in theoretical biology that are happening. Right? and which are going to turn into, say, systems theory. Right? These things are addressing a very different problematic from, say, information theory or computer science. Right? They're coming at this from a different angle altogether. This is Ludwig von Birkenlaufny writing in 1933, writing in a biological context, talking about this kind of clash between mechanism and vitalism. Right? So there's been this battle raging in the sciences, right? Since, you know, at least Descartes, right? Between people who are going to be believing in a, something like a soul, something like a vital force, something like a specificity of life on an ontological level, something that sets life apart from mere mechanism. And then there's going to be other people who are saying, no, it's all mechanical, it's all mechanical. There's nothing special. It all just proceeds like clockwork. And what people like Birkenlaufny and people who are thinking, you know, really the development of a kind of like modern biological theory, right, are thinking about sort of a synthesis of the two, right, or a third position. And it's an idea of thinking through, say, holism, right, in a way that's not mystical, right, thinking through what it means to have the context of the organism, what that context means, what does it mean to have the organism kind of oriented around itself as a whole, and how that might affect the biological facts. Now, a lot of this is not, you know, you'll see tensions here, right? You'll see, for instance, information theory, right, take over biology in, say, the 1950s with the discovery of DNA, right? You'll see a lot of these kind of system theoretical notions of what it means to be a living organism displaced, pushed to the side. They start to come back, right? They'll come back, say, starting in, you know, the past 20 years or so, right? So there is interesting tension. You know, this is not a uniform kind of all these disciplines just sort of come together and don't clash, right? There are displacements, there are disagreements with these things, there are incompatibilities. But Birkenlaufny will go on from these biological views to found what's called general system theory, right? And so this idea of thinking in terms of systems, thinking in terms of a logic that transcends this kind of mechanistic logic of parts, but is still amenable to a scientific treatment, is still able to be treated in a mathematical fashion, able to be reasoned about. So here we have this very clear definition. It's from 1968, but he was working on this stuff a lot earlier. And actually gets very very huffy about cybernetics in a lot of his writing, because he feels that cybernetics has basically stolen his thunder and kind of displaced general system theory. But the system problem is essentially the problem of the limitation of analytical procedures in science. This used to be expressed by half-metaphysical statements, such as emergent evolution, or the whole is more of a sum of its parts, but has a clear operational meaning. Right? And this is one of the things that cybernetics is going to be getting at, right? When it starts looking into how does feedback work, how does regulation work. Right? A lot of it is giving this kind of clear operational meaning to the behavior of the system. Okay, other stuff that goes into it. Well, operations research, right? And also developments in modern, related developments in economic theory. Right? So operations research, more or less, starts off with a British discipline. It's people who are really starting to just kind of boggle at the scale of the war that they're waging, right? And trying to think about, well, how do you actually make decisions about this war, right? Because the individual battle isn't cutting it, right? The individual, like, okay, we sunk a submarine. Well, great, you sunk a submarine. How many submarines did you sink? How much effort did it take to sink those submarines, right? Could you have sunk more submarines had you done something differently, right? So you get this whole kind of statistical apparatus, right? This is, I think, a photograph of a Pentagon office, right? But you get this whole kind of statistical apparatus that, of necessity, gets applied to the war machine, right? And operations research starts thinking in terms of optima, right? Starts thinking in terms of, like, well, you know, what is the ideal depth to drop our depth charges at, right? So that we, say, you know, don't scare off the submarines, but manage to inflict enough damage to destroy them, right? And these are questions that are not left to the genius of the general commanding the force. These are questions that are going to be analyzed with hard data over, you know, appropriate statistical scales, and you get a scientific answer to them. Right? Now, this notion of optima, this notion of being able to calculate these points at which you have, you know, the correct thing to do in terms of, like, how to maximize a certain variable, right, maximize a certain result, is also going on at the same time with an economic theory. And actually, one of the sort of people who figures into the Tertullian essay a bit, John von Neumann, is at the heart of this in thinking about being, in this book that comes out in 1647, it might have came out a little earlier, the theory of games and economic behavior. Right? So this idea of approaching approaching economics as a sort of similar problem, right? Thinking about the mechanisms by which these things are negotiated and thinking about where are the points at which, you know, we have equilibrium, right? Where do these equilibria emerge within the system? How do we reach them, right? This becomes a tremendously powerful, tremendously motivating force within economic theory as well, right? And von Neumann, incidentally, is like totally fascinating and kind of scary character because he's behind modern economic game theory, the digital computer, and the hydrogen bomb, as well as the theory of self-reproducing automata. So kind of a really, really, really interesting sort of figure in this history. And also kind of marginal to cybernetics in sort of very important ways, in a way that his trajectory intersects with cybernetics, but doesn't quite, you can't quite identify it with cybernetics. Okay, the other major input to all of this, right, in terms of what's going on at the same time, would be something that I might want to be tempted to call something like corporate futurism. There's this idea, right, because of the tremendous, tremendous amount of collaboration that goes on between academia, corporations, the military complex, right, and in terms of like very, very fundamental research, right? You know, we're talking about the birth of computer science, the birth of sort of you know, the applications of a common theory, right, being based on the very fundamental, you know, concerns of physics. We're talking about very wide-ranging kind of new approaches to sort of say, you know, statistical psychology. All of this stuff is, you know, these corporate structures are being and private structures, foundation structures, are all being mobilized in the war effort to help deal with this. And so what you get is a kind of sense of, you know, sort of corporate mission towards the future, right? And this is something that's really interesting, right? If we go back and look at it, this is a really good example of it. It's by no means the only one. But this is the World's Fair in Brussels in 1958. Even though it's a little later than, say, the birth of cybernetics, it still kind of belongs to this period. It's the first World's Fair after the Second World War, right? So if we're looking for this, you know, if we're looking for this periodization, if we're looking for, like, what are the structures of power really representing themselves as, World's Fairs are often a really good way to do that, right? You know, we can go back and look at the London Exposition, right? If we want to look at, like, you know, what that regime of power was all about, how did it project its own representation? So we get this one in Brussels. If anybody's seen the Brussels World's Fairgrounds, it's still there today. You've got the sort of atomic, sort of six-pointed atomic structure statue. One of the things that's not there is the Pome Electronique. This was a really interesting exhibition. This was Le Corbusier, right? Famous sort of French, you know, modern architect, right, designing machines for a living, collaborating with Xenaxis on the design of this mathematically inspired pavilion, right, which would have a kind of like really interesting sort of sensory program inside that would consist of music composed by Edgar Varèse, one of the pioneers of electronic music, as well as bizarre video projection, as well as, I believe, all sorts of strobe lighting and ambient sounds, which is the score by Varèse down here, as well as, I think, even smell, so I'm not sure about that. I might just be inventing that. But basically the idea was not only that this was going to be something futuristic and shiny looking, right, but that somehow Philips, right, Philips being this very big Dutch electricity corporation, that somehow they could create a new relationship through scale, through sheer overwhelming amount of stimuli between technology and the human sensory. Right? And here you see people lining up to go into the pavilion. It was actually really popular, right? And it's an interesting moment, right? You think about very large corporations coming, you know, out of a war effort, thinking in terms of, you know, getting the biggest names in experimental music and experimental composition and architecture to design something for mass consumption. Right? This is a very kind of peculiar moment that's going on. And this is something that plays into cybernetics as well. One of the things that you'll get, basically, is that the initial elaboration of cybernetics is going to happen under the aegis of what's called the Macy conferences. The Macy conferences are funded by the Josiah Macy Foundation. And basically, there is this kind of sense of, like, very large, you know, amounts of corporate or foundation money fueling this necessity to intervene in these kind of very large ways about, you know, this sort of self-definition of the relationship between technology and society, right? So this is which is this kind of perfect feature. I'll just give you a sense. If you want to see, you know, what the overall effect was, here's a little bit of a film that shows you what the sound projection would be like. Philips had an automatic apparatus developed that a new art with unlimited potentials contained, namely the electronic together play of light, color, sound, and music in space. The electronic poem presented by Fabricier along with monkeys and strange noises.
Wow.
That whole 60-minute video is online, and you have to kind of extrapolate from the YouTube window to I am inside a giant Le Corbusier math sinusoidal projection with the most advanced sound system of 1958, like projecting all around me. But it's interesting to think, you know, to think about what that kind of, you know, represents, right? That's not counterculture, right? That's official mass culture. So back to cybernetics itself. Right? Now, cybernetics, like I said, it's gathering together and giving a name to a cluster of related work at this time. Right? And it coheres for a time, right? And then the name kind of gets abandoned. Right? So some of the things we're talking about here are anti-aircraft weaponry. Right? This is the sort of classical locus of the development of cybernetics. Right? This is what Norbert Wiener is working on during World War II. And so what he'll be talking about is how to control an anti-aircraft gun. And this is a quote from the Gallison essay, which is really short, really clear, definitely worth a read. Right? But it's this idea of how do you think about the enemy? Right? How do you predict where the enemy is going to be ahead of time, and then just use that prediction to be able to eliminate the enemy? And you know, this is essentially what's going on, right? He builds these predictors that are built into the anti-aircraft guns, right? Or meant to be built into anti-aircraft guns that will basically allow you to extrapolate from the position of the enemy plane where it's going to be at, you know, time T plus, you know, however long it takes for you to press the trigger and for the shell to actually reach where you think the enemy is going to be. And the interesting thing is that, and Gallison will go into this quite a bit, is that while Wiener is very excited and very, you know, willing to contribute to the war effort, this doesn't actually get put into play. Right? There are other mechanisms that get built. There are other strategies for solving this problem that are implemented. Wiener's stuff doesn't really actually wind up, you know, it's not as if like the the Department of Defense is like, oh, thank you, you've given us our cybernetic solution, and now we can effectively control our anti-air press. What Galison talks a lot about looking at this period in Wiener's life is thinking about how Wiener very quickly starts thinking about larger questions, right? Starts thinking about what does this tell us about what it means to be human? Like, what is human nature such that we can, you know, that it becomes coupled with this system that involves a gun, involves an enemy, and so on and so forth. Some of the other things that we get here, right? Well, this basically prompts a number of wartime gatherings, right? There's people who are in the same research circles who start talking to each other about all this stuff. And that's going to basically provide the core for what's going to be known as the cybernetics group, right? Although it won't have that name until Wiener kind of recoins it. Other things that are going on here, teleological mechanisms, right? This is a big one. This is a paper from Rosenbluth, who I believe is a biologist and a neurologist. Norbert Wiener and Julian Bigelow, who's his collaborator on some of these anti-aircraft type weaponry. This is a paper that they published in a journal of philosophy in 43, so during the war, right? And thinking about behavior, purpose, and teleology. And you can see how immediately like the practical concerns are being left behind, right? Or there's kind of a territory that's being established where it's like, look, if we're going to talk about how to effectively shoot down an enemy plane, we have to rethink the history of philosophy, right? What it means to be human. Right? That's an interesting kind of moment. So this is this kind of explanation of their reinterpretation of teleology, right? Of being oriented towards a goal or towards an end. Right? Very old kind of philosophical concept, and they're giving it a spin that is basically saying, like, look, this is a matter of mechanisms that are designed in a certain way. Talking about some machines are intrinsically purposeful. A torpedo with a target-seeking mechanism is an example. So this is a kind of interesting sort of shift that's going on.
But the slide before.
Yeah.
I was trying to wrap my head around the servo-mechanical enemy. Like, I wonder if you could say like a little bit more about this idea, like for like the illusion of human and non-human. Just like, what's the idea here? Like, is it that he's modeling the behavior of the enemy in the servo-mechanical way, and that model is the people, or like,
yeah, I think it's like a little bit, you know, somebody else say a crack at the servo-mechanical enemy. I think it's largely kind of both. It's largely both about the process of modelization, but also about the process of sort of slotting the human into these systems. And the fact that the human is designed in a certain way, the fact that the human is designed along these lines allows you to sort of place the human into the system kind of somewhat flawlessly, right? There's no issue with, you know, no essential boundary between the servo mechanism and the human system, right? So you're able to integrate these systems and compose them or oppose them in this kind of manner. So other stuff that's going on with cybernetics, theory of norms. Right, this is another thing that comes out of cybernetics that's huge. And this is the basic sort of model of the cybernetic neuron. This is still basically the model we have today of how a neuron works and what the job of a neuron is, right? You'll have, let's get this wrong, it's this, like there are multiple synapses and one axon, right? And the idea is that you have a number of inputs. When those inputs combine, right, if none of them are going, or just a few of them are going, or just the very relatively unimportant ones are being triggered, then there's no output from the neuron. However, it gets to a certain stage, right? Crosses a threshold, then you get an output. And this is the cybernetic theory of neurons. And what they tried to do was sort of say, you know, you can do a lot with this, right? And you can do a lot with this precisely by thinking about how you would compose these simple elements in parallel, right? Or combine them into networks. Right? So the whole idea of neural networks. Our basic idea of how brain functioning works, right? What kind of processing structure in the brain date back to this early work in cybernetics. And here, this is what's called the McCulloch-Pitts neuron. That's Warren McCulloch, who's a really interesting figure in cybernetics. Is a kind of core participant for a really long time. Has some really interesting diatribes against psychoanalysis, which are worth reading for their kind of incoherency and virulence. And that's an even more interesting guy, Walter Pitts, who is, somebody needs to do a biography of Walter Pitts,
yeah,
like, seriously. Immediately. Yeah. He's kind of very strange, sort of quasi-idiot savant who was often kind of, would show up kind of homeless in the offices of people doing all this kind of research and then show them that the math was wrong, and kind of oscillates between being the poet's protege, then gets kind of adopted by Wiener, who then cuts him off, and then he winds up in a sort of spiral of alcoholism that leads to his death. So really bizarre character. And in fact, it's one of the things you find in the history of cybernetics is it's actually, it's not very, when we're talking about the people involved with cybernetics, actually there's a lot of sort of character depth here that, that can be the Tocchini essay, you just kind of get a sense of the same case with bureaucrat. Anyway, other things that are going on. Well, theory of regulation, right? Obviously, what it means to regulate a system. And here's one of the people who's, inventing the system of contemporary capitalism and control. William Ross Ashby wearing his hat. This is a sort of British cybernetician who then comes over to the United States and is responsible for a lot of kind of popularization of cybernetics and a lot of really interesting sort of machinery. This is the homeostat that he builds, which is basically a machine that whose entire purpose is to demonstrate self-regulation. So it's a really interesting kind of technical artifact. Kind of making manifest these cybernetic processes in a way that's being made possible by, precisely by wartime surplus. These are like, I think, target plotters or something that he's readapted for this purpose. And also responsible for what's called the law of requisite variety, which is this idea that only variety can destroy variety. And it's this idea that essentially if you're trying to control a system, you need to have as many, the controlling mechanism has to have as many degrees of freedom as the system to be controlled, right? That if you have a system that, has two options, right? And, or if you have a system that has like, say, or a controlling device, say, that only has two options or two potential responses, it's not going to be able to control something that can be in, any one of 100 different states, right? It's not going to be able to do that. And that's a really, that really provides the book, the sort of theoretical foundation for a lot of what's going to happen in cybernetics. Other stuff, again, there's a tendency to reduce cybernetics just down to what's going on in America with, say, the circle that starts around Wiener during the war and then gradually expands to the Macy conferences. Not really entirely the case. There's a lot of really interesting British cybernetics work going on, so similar circles. This is the Gray Walters robots again. This is a sort of time-lapse track of the robots with a light on them sort of rotating around these light sources. There's also interesting stuff that's going on elsewhere in the world. I know there's a really interesting strain of cybernetics that's going in South America, particularly in Chile, which we can come back to. But again, this whole idea of autonomous systems, right? The first autonomous robot systems were built, right? That's a kind of, a strange legacy, right? To go back and think about those turtles and then think about not only Roombas, but also predator drones and this kind of thing, right? So there definitely is something of a start to something here. Other things that are going on, well, claims about any system whatsoever, right? This having basically invented a way, right, a name with cybernetics for describing systems as a whole, right? Gets very, very prevalent, especially in the Macy conferences, right, which are explicitly convened as this kind of very broad, very interdisciplinary moment. Right? So these conferences will last from 1946 to 1953. They take place, by and large, in a hotel in New York City. They're funded by this Hoziah Macy Foundation. And they convene this really interesting group of people. Right? Initially, it includes Wiener. It's going to include a lot of other people. This guy Ashby is going to be there. McCulloch is going to be there. Wiener will eventually leave after the first couple. Von Neumann will do something similar. But you also have people like Gregory Bateson there, right, and Margaret Mead. Right? So there's this kind of this kind of understanding that what these conversations are about are taking these new sciences, right, which at the start of the Macy conference, they don't have the name cybernetics. Right? The first one is called feedback mechanisms and circular causal systems in biological and social systems. Right? So you can see why there was this push to take cybernetics and make it into a name, because you needed something that wasn't quite that long to describe what we were about. But the Macy conferences are really interesting, right? And some of the stuff that Tocchini is talking about is coming out of that, coming out of those circles, especially looking at like, sort of what what Margaret Mead was doing, some of this stuff that was talked about, like in terms of the World Mental Health Federation, right, is coming out of the sort of softer social sciences side of what's going to become the cybernetics group. But you see this a lot, right? You see in all of this kind of cybernetic stuff, this kind of desire or this belief that these conceptual, scientific, mathematical, technological tools have immediate and important relevance for social systems, right? So this is Wiener's Human Use of Human Beings, which is essentially the book he publishes to sort of take cybernetics to a wider audience, right? It's much less technical than the book Cybernetics, which starts off very informally, talking about Newton and Bergson, and then it's like 70 pages of formulas. This one, right, in the thesis of the book, that society can only be understood through a study of the messages and the communication facilities that belong to it, the future development of these messages and communication facilities, messages between men and machines, between machines and men, between machine and machine are destined to play an ever-increasing part. It's very kind of clear where this is going. Now, there's interesting stuff about the politics of the MACI conferences. One of the things, if we get around to it, I'm going to start watching DOSNETs, I'm not sure if we will. But in DOSNETs, one of the key players in the MACI conferences was a guy by the name of Frank Fremont Smith, who also would be one of the people who would be involved with MKUltra. Right? So there's a really bizarre, I mean, the MACI Foundation was, according to a lot of the stuff that's come out, basically the way in which the CIA kind of laundered the money that was going to the research on LSD that was being done. So there's interesting, weird, you know, like to say that this is like, there definitely is something of a nexus here for a certain kind of approach that, you know, leads us to cast a bit more of a suspicious eye towards the MACI conferences than we might normally. Anyway, other stuff that comes out of cybernetics, and I'm almost done here. Ecology, right? Modern ecological science, in terms of thinking about the way in which we conceptualize complicated circular causal networks, interdependence between different parts of an ecological system. That's basically all coming out of George Evelyn Hutchinson, right? There's a core MACI conference participant, right? You see, it's well known from mathematical theory that circular paths often exist, which tend to be self-correcting within certain limits, but which break down, producing violent oscillations when some variable in the system transgresses given values. That's essentially, I mean, this is the, as far as I understand, essentially the paper that defines sort of modern ecological science. You can see it's very, very super indebted to the theory of cybernetics. And this is something that recurs, right? Bateson, for instance, will be the first person to pose global warming as a project for the left. That'll happen in 1968 at this kind of really interesting Dialectics of Liberation conference that happens in London. And then you have like C.R. James, Stokely Carmichael, Arne Lang, Gregory Bateson, Paul Goodman, and all these other people there. Bateson's presentation will largely be about global warming, right? And will be coming out of this kind of cybernetic theory of regulation. Right? So that's, you know, some of the sort of ecological effects of cybernetics. And then finally, well, maybe we have something like neoliberalism or control of cybernetics as well. Right? There's definitely people involved with cybernetics who go on to do some very sketchy things, right? One of them is this fellow by the name of Carl Deutsch, who I believe the Tattoo essay talks about quite a bit. Writes this book called The Nerves of Government, right? Models of Political Communication and Control, right? You can see even in the subtitle, right? He's obviously invoking this kind of cybernetics idea. And essentially, this is this book that really tries to argue for a new model of government, right? A model of government that's going to essentially, rather than sort of just being about the exercise of power, right, in this kind of clear way, in this kind of way that is, you know, perhaps contestable, it's going to argue for a kind of part of government as the way of avoiding conflict, right? Of structuring the sort of communicative structures that function within society in such a way that conflict just doesn't arise. And he also will invent, you know, the concept of something like the security community, right, in international relations, right? So definitely a sketchy, sketchy character. There's other sort of sketchy characters from, you know, the standpoint of anti-capitalism who are involved with cybernetics as well, right? So for instance, the first meetings on self-organizing systems, which happened, you know, basically coming out of, that happened towards the end of the 50s, right, coming out of the momentum of the MACI conferences, somebody who's there, like Hayek will be there, right? And Hayek will pick up on a lot of this kind of discourse around information theory, discourse around thinking about social systems as systems for transmitting information back and forth. And that'll go into a lot of Hayek's kind of like post-war reformulation, right, of, you know, essentially neoliberalism, right? Things like the catalaxy, right, the sort of renaming of the economic system as this kind of self-organizing system. A lot of this is coming out of the cybernetic heritage as well. So there definitely, you know, to say that like there's a connection between our modern structures of control of capitalism and cybernetics is not, you know, it's not entirely a conjecture, right? There definitely are these moments of historical connection. All right. So that's what I had to say for the introduction, and now hopefully I can